And if I were to give to each of us different pieces of paper and a pencil and ask you to put down the topics that you felt would be important on the theme of pure and practical Christianity, you would probably put down many of the issues that we find on the schedule this time. But I appreciate one that I would not have put and others perhaps would not list, and that is the topic of the Christian and work ethic. I appreciate this because I think that it may be, or at least was for me, an unmined field of inquiry or thought. What are my responsibilities as a child of God when it pertains to industry, to producing, to accomplishing, and doing? I know that Christianity is an eminently practical religion. It is meant to influence everything about the way we live, the way we think, what we decide, and what we do. This next week, you may spend the majority of your time at a work site or engaged in some occupation. It is an enormous portion out of our week. And so it is fitting, I think, that that should be a topic that we address as a part of the business of Christian living. Tonight, I would like for us to think about such questions as these. What are our responsibilities toward work? Is there a limit to them? What do we do? Don't we want to rid ourselves of work obligations? How do we manage issues of benevolence with those funds that we have and resources that have been entrusted to our care? And how do we manage, this is one perhaps overlooked sometimes, how do we manage success when we become prosperous, when we achieve, when we gain? How do we make certain that that success is not ultimately the reason for our failure as God's people? Well, we begin tonight talking just about the issue of work itself. And if we were to ask the average person on the street here in Odessa or wherever you may live, what would your picture of paradise be? I wonder how many times we might hear someone say it involves a beach, clear blue water, and something cool to drink. And nothing to do, no worries, no concerns, nothing that I have to tend to. When I look in the pages of the book of Genesis, chapter 3, after the sin that took place in that garden, I read there in the closing verses that as God is speaking first to the serpent, then to Eve, and then to Adam, he tells Adam that the ground is now cursed because of what they have done, and he will labor and with toil and sweat bring forth the food that he needs to survive. And that may be how many think about work and productivity, that we go, we sweat, we labor, it is odious, it is distasteful, but we have to do it. What I'm intrigued by is that if you look back in chapter 2, that is before that fall into sin, and verse number 15, the Bible shows us a picture of paradise that doesn't involve anything with beaches or cool drinks and no responsibilities. The text says there that God took the man, Adam, placed him in the garden, and assigned him certain responsibilities or duties. Adam's responsibility was to tend and to keep the garden, paradise itself. And so perhaps it is a surprise to us to realize that work does not have to be conceived of as distasteful or unpleasant. That there can be practical aspects to it that are useful, that are helpful, and that we ought to appreciate as we take a better glance at this. Maybe we should realize that just prior to that, in chapter 1, at the beginning of chapter 2, that God himself labored. He undertook these great measures. He created the universe, our world, everything that inhabits them. And after that 6 days of creative work, chapter 2, verses 1 through 3 says that God then took a Shabbat, or a rest, from the labors. That rest on that seventh day becomes the model that the Israelites will follow, beginning in chapter 16 of the book of Exodus. So productivity and then a period of recreation or rest can be a good thing. It can be appropriate when understood in the right sense. I suspect that there are people all around the world, countless, who would love the opportunity to work and to be productive, but they are precluded, at least by two different things, perhaps more. There are some I know who would like to be able to provide, but they have their own disabilities of whatever type, that prevent them from being able to work, to achieve, to accomplish. Then there are those who may live in a portion of the world where there's simply nothing for them to do in the immediate locale where they find themselves. Now that may sound strange to us in America, where we think there's something, go out and be industrious or busy. But it's also strange to think that there are parts of the world where there are people who literally have nothing to feed their children before they go to bed. There are people who literally have no means of bringing home food, potable water, to have a structure to live in that is reliable, it is safe, it protects. There are people who would love to be able to work and to accomplish and to achieve, to provide the things that they need. Many of them look to the United States and call to mind this phrase, the American dream. Do you realize that for most of them, the American dream is not to sit on a beach and to drink a cool beverage? The American dream represents an opportunity to be industrious, to achieve something that is substantive, it is meaningful, it is profitable. And they don't want someone to do it for them. What they want is the opportunity to do it for themselves. That is historically the nature of the American dream. A poem written in the 1800s by Edith Wharton, is that right? Is at the base of the Statue of Liberty. It begins with those familiar words, give us your tired, your poor, your huddled masses, yearning to breathe free. We just want a place to work. Brethren, to be able to be industrious is more of a blessing than sometimes people give credit. When Solomon would write in Proverbs chapter 12 and verse number 11, he spoke of the independence that comes with productivity. He would speak there and say, he that tills his land shall be satisfied. The one who goes, works, accomplishes, can come home and be at peace. Something good has transpired. Just a few verses later, chapter 13 and verse number 4, he compares the two issues that maybe we are comparing this evening. He speaks and he says, the soul of the sluggard, that's the lazy person who doesn't want to get up and doesn't want to work. He said, the soul of the sluggard desires, there is a longing, but he does not have. In contrast, the verse closes, the soul of the diligent will be made fat. And that is biblical language for be satisfied, be at peace, because something good has happened. A person can come home, feel good about what they've done. I think about our responsibilities, and I stand here tonight before you as a husband and as a father. My family looks to me for the things that I'm able to provide. And God says that a part of the work ethic that humanity is to recognize is that I have a responsibility to provide. I really want to draw attention this evening to the book of 1 Timothy chapter 5 and the 8th verse. I believe that principle presents such an umbrella under which so many elements that we're discussing this evening are found. 1 Timothy chapter 5. In that 5th chapter, Paul is talking to his young friend Timothy, and I believe the idea is that Timothy will learn these lessons, and then Timothy will go out and communicate these lessons so that others understand. It is to be propagated. He talks to Timothy and tells him how to relate to others who are in the body of Christ. And he even talks about the fact that there may be those, and he has in mind widows especially, whom the church may need to help. In those ancient periods, we did not have, or they did not have, the social programs that many are dependent upon today. And so it would be by benevolence or care from others that many would be cared for. Now, Paul says that it may be that someone who has been a servant of the Lord can be cared for by the church, but that is not the first option. In chapter 5, in verse number 8, he places the responsibility for meeting the physical needs of family members squarely upon the shoulders of family members, and especially family leaders. Notice this verse. He says, if anyone provides not for his own, especially for those of his own house, he has denied the faith, and he is worse than an infidel, worse than a pagan who does not even believe in God, let alone concern himself or herself with the lifestyle of a Christian. Paul says it is important that I, as a father and as a husband, provide for the needs of my family. I realize that it's not always possible for me to meet every need. Sometimes people confuse needs with just wants. But even in the realm of needs, people become sick. Employment is terminated. People find themselves scrambling to tie things together. And there is room for benevolence. Because what Paul is commending is responsibility, a diligent attention given to those cares that rightly rest with us. And so I need to be productive because God's expectations for my dealing with my family demand it. Demand it. If I may take just a moment here to expand in a direction that may not have occurred to us before. When we provide those things that our families need, I want to say the words life insurance to you tonight. Now that may sound odd, but I hope that in about 2 minutes it won't. In my family, I'm the primary breadwinner. My wife is a kindergarten teacher. That helps. It does not cover all of our needs. If I were to expire on my way home, something horrible happened as I journeyed back, how would my wife survive? We have three small children. I know of a situation right now in which a man in his early 40s died very suddenly, leaving his wife and children with nothing. As a consequence, it is the selling of the home and moving back in the 40s, with elderly, aged parents. What I'm saying is that we ought to take care not only of our homes with homeowners, our cars with car insurance, but consider what your family would do if you were no longer there to provide, as 1 Timothy 5 and verse 8 says. It's cheap. For about the price of two pizzas or taking the children to McDonald's, you can make certain every month that your family is cared for. And I believe that that falls under that rubric or heading of providing for our own. I would hate to think of myself being in the repose of the bosom of Abraham and looking back at my wife and my three young children on earth and watching them scramble to have a home to live in, to have food on the table and clothes to wear. So I'm encouraging us tonight to think in a forward-looking fashion about how we cover in case of any unforeseen circumstance. Let me give you another one that I would like to mention. It is a last will and testament. My wife and I have traveled on a couple of occasions together overseas in gospel work and campaigns. And just in March, we traveled to Jamaica in a campaign. And I have to tell you that as I fly over the ocean and I look down, I think, what will happen to my children if this airplane should fail in some fashion and we both lose our lives? Who's going to care for our children? I need to have a will because that tells what I want to do with things that are under my power or jurisdiction. And when people think of wills, we think of cars, automobiles, furniture, the possessions, the jewelry. For a person with young children, that includes children. Because whenever we pass away without a will, the state takes over. And very often the children are sent to those who are closest related by blood. And yet, how many of us, please do not show your hands, how many of us have blood relatives that would be the first to receive the custodianship of our children, whom we know would rear them to be faithful Christians and to help them reach heaven as a goal? Now, how many of us? Our last will and testament is the last opportunity that we have to say what we want to happen to those things, including our family members and our children, under our power. It is our last statement. And I may well choose, if circumstances dictate, that I don't want my children to be reared by someone to whom they are blood related. Because while they might provide for their physical and emotional needs, they won't meet the spiritual. So I may decide, in conjunction with my wife, that we want them to go to the home of fellow Christians, whom I know will rear them. And we'll put the statements in there about knowing their family members. We're not cutting anyone off. But when the final decision is made, I want it to be a brother or sister who is faithful in the Lord. And if a family member objects and says, "You are not trusting us," the failure is not on our part. The failure is on their part to have demonstrated themselves prior to be faithful children of God who will help my children go to heaven. And brethren, if I don't say anything else with force tonight, let it be this. My children's spiritual needs outweigh my family members' emotional distress and having that taken and placed somewhere else. They deserve it. So while we talk about industry, providing, protecting, let me suggest that we each look to these couple of areas that I've just mentioned. I believe there is biblical precedent for being responsible in these particular areas. And I want my children to be in heaven. I want all of my family members. But if I have only one chance to say what I would like to see happen, I want to take that opportunity. And I want to say it clearly so that good decisions can follow. There is a great sense of accomplishment in working and achieving. In the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 2, and Ecclesiastes falls in the great wisdom literature of the Old Testament. It's called the wisdom literature, Job through the Song of Solomon, because it doesn't deal primarily with the recounting of history, although there are historical elements. It doesn't deal primarily with the presentation of doctrine or commandments, although those elements are certainly present. They're called the wisdom literature because they represent the presentation of principles of guidance for life. They ask and answer the great questions, why am I here? Where am I going? What should I be pursuing? And it is to that latter that I turn our attention, Ecclesiastes 2 and verse 24. Solomon says, there is nothing better for a man than that he should eat and drink, and that he should make his soul enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw that it was from the hand of God. It is a real blessing to be able to go to bed at night, whether we've worked at off-site somewhere or we've worked at our own home, to be able to go to bed in exhaustion, to put our heads on the pillows and to know that we earned sleep by working diligently and productively. That is a good feeling that far too many people deprive themselves of. And perhaps, just perhaps, an equally good feeling of awakening the next morning and saying, I get to work on this. I'm not so naive as to suggest that every means of employment is lovely or something that someone would choose. My father was a brick mason when I was growing up. That is a hard and tedious job. I have worked in various places. I worked in a coal mine on one occasion. And I remember the man sitting up in the cab of the Caterpillar bulldozer as we were taking a moment's break. It was 100 million degrees outside. And he said, you stay in school because you don't want to do this for the rest of your life. And you know what? He was dead on. I did not. If it's necessary, do it. That's okay. But still, to be able to look at your children and to your family and to those you know and care about, and to know that whether it was hard or not, distasteful or not, we have contributed to something meaningful. That is a reward in itself, and it is not to be dismissed. It also means that perhaps we have the opportunity to assist others even beyond our own family. It especially touches the work of the church, a great congregation. I know of the track record of this congregation. In a sense, I know people who have look back fondly to their time here, to the work that has been done by brethren here, and repeated among other congregations around the world. The fact that I may be someone working in my profession means that I can help to support those kinds of works that make an eternal impact. John would write to his good friend Gaius, the book of 3 John in verse number 8. And John was extremely complimentary because he spoke to Gaius and he said, you had these Christian missionaries apparently who came through. And he said, you helped them on their way. In verse number 8, he says, you have become a fellow helper to the truth. You may not be the person who travels around the world or across the country. You may not be the person who stands in the pulpit or even leads the Bible study in your own home. But when you, by your productivity, are able to contribute to and support those who do those things, you're a part of that winning team. You are a fellow helper to the truth, and so am I. That means that we are doing something significant. Jesus lived that way. Did you know that? I know that Jesus' profession was apparently as a carpenter. Would have learned that from his father. But when Jesus went in his 30th and 31st, 32nd, 33rd year, when he went on his preaching tours all around Judea and Palestine, he wasn't able to be a carpenter. I wouldn't expect so. And I know that Peter and Andrew, James and John made their living by fishing the Sea of Galilee. So what do they do while they are in Judea for a month or 2 months or more? Well, in the book of Luke, chapter number 8, verses 1 through 3, I think this is a beautiful passage. Because the text there says that Mary Magdalene, whom, by the way, I would be willing to argue may have been Jesus' most faithful disciple ever, Mary Magdalene, Joanna, Susanna, and many other ladies ministered unto him out of their substance. Jesus was supported in his preaching tours because they had resources that they believed should be committed to this work. Number one, those resources had been gained. That's the work ethic issue. And number two, they had supported with those. That's the fellow helper to the truth aspect. They were patronesses to Jesus. A good study, by the way, for any preacher looking for a topic would be the life of Mary Magdalene and her closeness, the connection that she felt to Jesus. When we say all of these things, however, I recognize that there are limits or boundaries on certain things regarding our association to work. The first is that you are not your work. Neither am I. In the Western society, and certainly in America, very often we identify ourselves by our profession. It almost makes a pecking order or a hierarchy. We want our children to be doctors and lawyers. Why? Prestige and earning power. Forget about the early heart attacks and the stress. Prestige and earning power. The bottom line is, though, one is not an engineer. That's what you do for a living. This person over here is not a cashier in a grocery store. That's what they do for a living, perhaps. But Christians especially should recognize that who we are and what we are derives not from our work. It derives from Jesus Christ and the relationship that we have with God through Him. Which is why a person could lose a job. Stressful? Yes. End of existence? No. Because that's not how we ultimately define ourselves. People who look at themselves by means of their profession very often become workaholics, and in the process they ignore other concerns, whether family, spiritual, whatever, recreational, health. They give themselves completely to a pursuit. When Bill Gates was creating his Microsoft Windows operating system in the early 1980s, it is said that he was so consumed with the creation of this project that he would go for days without bathing. He obviously didn't have a problem with women either. It was too important for him to complete his job. Now, the Bible tells us that there is a right place for work, and then there is the pursuit of things that is excessive. For example, in 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 10, it doesn't say that money is the root of evil. There have been many righteous people who had possessions. But what it does say is that the love of money is the root of all evil. It is the desire to work and to give up anything else except achieving and gaining. And that is a hollow victory for those who reach that brass ring. When we were in Jamaica last month, as I mentioned, we ran across a similar and yet somewhat different issue of working so much. There was a sister there who knew that we were going to cross paths with her husband, who's a member of the church, but wayward. And we chatted a moment, and she begged us. She said, "Will you talk to him and encourage him to be faithful? Because he is so concerned about having enough and having enough for our family that he is working all the time and he is ignoring the Lord completely." She said, "We don't need as much as he thinks we need. And he's driven by fear." Fear of not having enough very often causes people to place their priorities in the wrong position, wrong order. Jesus spoke truly in Matthew 6, 33, 34. "Seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these other things that we need will be added." They'll take care of themselves. That was the situation that she needed. But God needs to be the center of our lives. A similar problem that sometimes people encounter that I want to draw on is that we never should let ourselves be divided in our loyalties. Workplaces may ask us to do things that are good and right. They may also ask us to do things that are unethical or immoral. I got a telephone call from a fellow one time, a friend of mine, a member of the church. And he's about my age and had a wife and two small children. He was the sole breadwinner for his family. And he said, Rick, he said, I got a problem. He said, at my work, they want me to falsify the driver's logs because he worked for a construction company driving a truck. And he said, I know I shouldn't do that. He said, I could lose my job over this. Now, he really knew what was right, and I didn't have to say much. I just listened. I think what he wanted was someone who understood the problem and that he could talk to and be dependent upon. We had a good conversation. So he went back to work the next day, and when they made that request, he walked in and he told them, I can't do that. That is unethical. And as a result of him saying that, he kept his job. And he didn't have to do anything that his conscience would be violated by or that God would be displeased about. And if he had, there would have been brethren, I'm sure, to help support and to help hold him while he got back going again. But it's wrong for us to let our work obligations become our primary obligations, especially concerning the direction that our lives take. In the book of Leviticus 25 and verse 55, one of those favorite verses again, because of what it embodies. In the 25th chapter of that book, God had been speaking through Moses about issues of slavery and servitude. And while other nations could be held in slavery by the Israelites, he put this one very strong restriction. He said, no Israelites are to be slaves of anybody. Now, they could work off a debt. You might think of a butler or a maid, you know, something working off a debt. But that's different than being a slave or a servant in that sense. The reason for that, or the rationale, is given in verse 55. When he speaks and he says, unto me, the children of Israel are servants. And he says, the reason I have brought them out of the land of Egypt, and he concludes that verse and the whole discussion by saying, I am the Lord thy God, which is a claim for ultimate supremacy or authority. Whenever someone else makes a claim, we ought to remember whom we belong to and honor that one, that is God, in everything that we do. I think of Paul's words in 2 Corinthians 6 and verse 14. We know that one where it says, be not unequally yoked together with unbelievers. We often think of the moral character of our friends and the people that our children are hanging around with. Well, I suggest it also applies to those work situations. I may work for a non-Christian. I may work with a non-Christian. And it may be that the nature of our relationship does not in any way demand that I do something inappropriate or unrighteous in God's sight. But if it should, and I am pressured to yield and expected to yield, then we've become out of balance. I have yoked myself to the wrong person. I need to reconsider that type of relationship. I need to be pure and belong to God first and foremost. And then we mentioned the words a couple of minutes ago. We're not to let success ruin us. Oftentimes people achieve or they reach some level of satisfaction or possessions so that they feel like they are now in the driver's seat of life. Even though James says that our lives are but vapors and we don't ultimately have the final say-so of what happens and when. The writer of the book of Proverbs, chapter 30, verses 8 and 9, was aware of this pitfall. He spoke in verse 8 and he says, give me neither poverty nor riches. Now, we might say, of course, not the poverty, but why would you say, don't give me riches? And chapter 30 and verse 9, in the very first portion of that verse, gives the reason. Lest I should be full. And he says, deny God. I don't need you anymore. I'm self-sufficient. That is deception. It is a common one. In the end, I cannot on my own effect my eternal salvation. I will not be able to stand in the presence of God on my own merits, that is, completely apart from God and from Jesus Christ. It can't happen. And so success should never go to our heads or leave us thinking that we don't need God. Jesus told a parable about this in Luke chapter 12, verses 16 through 21, when he said, the ground of a certain rich man brought forth plentifully. So the rich man was vexed. He said, where will I put to bestow all of my fruits? He said, I know I will pull down my barns and build bigger so that I will have where to bestow all of my fruits. And then I will say to my soul, soul, thou hast much good laid up for many years. Take thine ease, eat, drink, and be merry. And then God says, thou fool, tonight thy soul shall be required of thee. Jesus summarized the problem in verse 21 when he said, "This is the person who has laid up treasure for himself but is not rich toward God." No matter what successes we may experience in a secular sense, we are always dependent upon God. Benevolence. You've heard the phrase, perhaps, I know that many have, God helps those who help themselves. Now, I haven't found that in the Bible or in my concordance yet, but I wouldn't be surprised if it were there. I think that it's inherently biblical and understood in the right way. Spiritually, God helps those who help themselves. Grace is held out to those who would take advantage. Philippians chapter 2 and verse 12, Paul writes to Christians and he says, "Work out your own salvation with fear and trembling." And that doesn't mean go to the side and think that you can cut a deal with God, as someone might say. But what he means is that ultimately you're responsible for the decisions that you make, people in the city of Philippi, people standing right here. So spiritually I contribute, physically I also contribute. In Proverbs chapter 6, in verse number 6 beginning, the writer there, Solomon, speaks and he says, "Go to the ant, thou sluggard." Literally, walk over and watch the ant. He says the ant is industrious. The ant has no overseer. That is, doesn't have to have someone tapping him on the shoulder and say, "Work." But he has what he needs. Verse 11 concludes, "The person who doesn't work doesn't. The one who does, does." And so God is concerned that we do work to provide. Now, what happens if there is someone who does not have? It happens. Well, I would suggest, first of all, that we are to be benevolent to other people. In Galatians chapter 6 and verse number 10, the writer there, Paul, says, "As we therefore have opportunity, let us do good unto all men, especially to those who are of the household of faith." The church is a benevolent, that is, goodwill organization. We focus on the spiritual. We want people to reach heaven, but it's true that there may be those around us who need some assistance. And both John and James is the one who's always criticized for this as a matter of works, but both John and James, 1 John chapter 3, both say, what's good about saying, "Go, be warm and be filled," and then doing nothing to help? We ought to take action on behalf of other people, if such is warranted. Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 28, "Let him that stole steal no more, but let him rather labor, working with his hands that thing which is good, that he might have to give to him that hath need." My productivity and work ethic means that I can come to the rescue. Have you ever heard of a family member who said, "I just need some help, it's a crisis moment," and you wished that you had a little bit more in your bank account or a little bit more that you could draw on to give? You're not offering to sustain them in their own indolence or laziness. You're wanting to help, and so am I. And so Paul and the New Testament and God say it's good for us to be ready to help those who truly need it. I would say, as a young preacher who was somewhat left on his own in a couple of circumstances, I would have appreciated a congregation having a very nicely arranged plan on how to enact benevolent measures on behalf of other people. What circumstances do we recognize that might really need help? To discriminate from those who simply would like a handout and don't want to do anything. What do we help with? How much do we help? How often do we help? Who is it that's going to verify this person has a genuine need? In Austin, we have a retired police officer. He keeps copious files. And he'll talk to the person and assess, "Tell me a little bit about your background." And the person who really has need doesn't mind sharing. "This is where I am. I'm embarrassed, but I really need some help. I won't be back. I don't like this." It's good to be careful, because as you and I are entrusted with the resources of the church, we've got to dispense with them wisely and utilize them and get the full value for them. But the church needs to be a benevolent organization in as far as it can and with the boundaries that fit with our identity as God's people. I would also say that's certainly true with regard to spiritual things. In Matthew chapter 9, verses 36 through 38, Jesus, he looked out, he saw the multitudes, and the text says he was moved with compassion upon them. Because the text says they were distressed and they were like sheep without a shepherd. Jesus had compassion upon people who were confused in life, lost in life. He even had compassion to provide miraculously fish and bread for those who were far away from a place to eat for the evening. Christianity is not about being indifferent to the needs of the body. It is about asking people to do their efforts first, and then we will assist. We don't want to enable or to abuse the thought of benevolence. We want to understand it. We want to employ it. We want to make a difference. And all of it is done, and should be, I think, all of it is done with reference to the name of Jesus the Christ. That's what sets the church as a benevolent organization apart from United Way or others that may be good inherently. But you know, in Matthew chapter 5 and verse 16, Jesus says, "Let them see your good works that they may do what?" The last part should not be overlooked, that they may glorify your Father which is in heaven. That means that as we work, people see that this is an expression of the love of God exhibited through the body of Christ, which is the church. It's okay to let people know that we're taking benevolent actions as a Christian response to a need. In all of these things, brothers and sisters, there are things that we ought to consider, principles to operate by. And while it may not seem so appealing to have the alarm clock go off at 5:30 in the morning, on Monday morning to get up and to go do all of that work again, in reality, it is a privilege to be able to tend to matters, to be able to provide what we need and what our families need. It is a privilege to know that we've cared for those who are in our purview or responsibilities. It's also a privilege to know that we can help the church, that we can help spiritual matters move forward and the kingdom of Jesus Christ, just like Mary Magdalene, Joanna, Susanna, and others, Gaius included. In all these things, I believe if a person is responsible in spiritual things, they'll probably be responsible in physical, and vice versa. But if someone is derelict, markedly derelict in one area, it may not point to the area, it may point to character issues that need to be addressed. We want to be faithful in all of the responsibilities that God hands to us, serving as those who are servants of Jesus Christ Himself with integrity, with honesty, and an overarching sense of purpose. This is who I am. May God bless us, everyone, as we labor in His name.